Hello again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast in which I talk to an artist about their work and something of their life. Enigmatic and unpredictable are just two adjectives that have been used to describe the work of my guest today. Christian Evju was born in Norway in 1980, but studied art in Britain. He did his fine art degree at Edinburgh College of Art and followed it up with an MA at Chelsea College of Art in London. Christian works in series, in both pencil and paint. In them, he incorporates drawings based on archival photographs, and he often includes geometric elements as well. His themes revolve around interpretations of reality and issues in society, which he treats in both a realistic and surrealistic way. He's won many prizes. These include the Comte à Paris Drawing Prize and the Figurative Art Prize by the Federation of British Artists. Two of his drawings were recently acquired by the British Museum for their permanent collection. I spoke to him from his London studio. Christian, welcome to the Considering Art podcast. Nice to see you again.
Thank you very much. Good to see you too.
Tell us a bit about your background. You are from a kind of remote part of Norway.
I am. I grew up with an artist's dad, which is, I guess, a little bit different. That's probably the reason why I'm in the art world at all. It was no act of rebellion or, you know, sort of thinking outside the box or anything. But I'm from a small village in rural kind of it's a small mountain village in Norway. Very few people, 300 people there.
So your father encouraged you, obviously, into art. Now, he's a romantic landscape painter, I believe, which is quite unlike what you do.
He encouraged me in a way that was, he wasn't on purpose. He wasn't trying to sort of encourage me to become an artist. I think it was more the fact that we would always draw things. And I think it was a way of telling stories, like really just back and forth. You know, we would sit down around the table and I would tell him to draw things for me. And I was allowed to draw on his drawings. It was this kind of very relaxed way of looking at mark making and telling stories. So I think that was that. And kind of that part of it is still present in my practice now, I think.
Did your father encourage you to paint things like landscapes, still lifes, or was he sort of someone who would prefer you to imagine something and draw it?
I think the way that he worked and the way that he spoke about things, I don't think he was attempting to influence me in any way, because it's quite welcoming to new ideas. But I think, obviously, when you show your enthusiasm to your own child, I guess, like, you will influence them in quite a strong way. And our mark making is really similar, like, compared to my siblings. My handwriting and everything is very similar to my dad. So I think then you presume a lot of other things are similar. So I think, yeah, it was a starting point. But there was no attempt to stop me when I started doing kind of other things.
You've actually exhibited with your father, I believe.
Yeah, twice actually. Because he's been working in a very non-traditional way, more towards craft, more towards theatre, with fairy tales and with filmmakers and museums, but making tableaus and kind of exhibits for history exhibitions, etc. So not so much in the fine arts. So we had a first show together in 2012. I asked him whether he wanted to show with a gallery, and he was like, yeah, it'd be nice. And so that was his first kind of official gallery show, and that was a very interesting experience. And then we had, later on, he was contacted by a museum to do a museum show in a historical museum, and he said, well, I'd like to do it, but then he wants to invite me to show alongside him as a kind of continuation of his practice, but in a sense of family, which was an absolutely lovely experience to kind of celebrate like his practice and then showing a little bit of what I'm doing and kind of celebrate that bond that you have with somebody that's flesh and blood, but also you share such a
passion.
Painting is a very physical thing.
You said at the beginning that you didn't think out of the box. You didn't rebel because you'd become an artist, but you decided to study psychology, first of all.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think, I guess like growing up with somebody who's following their passion already and exploring what that might mean. And it can be a very sort of introspective pursuit. And when I was a teenager, late teens, when you sort of decides what you're going to do with your life, and I was thinking I didn't want it to be so focused on me. And so that's where the psychology kind of came into the picture. Back then, you also had to do philosophy and ethics before you entered the University of Oslo, which I think was a clever thing that they did, that you don't have to do it anymore. But I think it's to have a basis in philosophy before you study the other sciences, I think is incredibly helpful. So so that was the plan, to become a psychologist or to work within the field somehow. And then, but then with the kind of door open, so if I changed my mind, I made a deal with myself that I could study art for a year and see how that went. Sort of like a gap year. So I did that. But to be fair, I'm glad I studied psychology before because I think, like, especially in higher education in the arts, there's a lot of overlaps. And I think in the universities here, I studied at Chelsea and also Edinburgh College of Art, there's a lot of kind of surface skimming of things like psychology and philosophy.
I mean, I've noticed that in your work, there is a big influence of psychology, I would guess, because you deal a lot with things like memory, identity, self-awareness. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I had some great advice from one of my professors at Edinburgh College of Art in my second year, and I remember it really well because I was struggling to figure out what kind of painter I wanted to be and what I wanted to work with. And, you know, it's not so easy to kind of figure out who you are when you're early 20s, and she said, like, try not to separate your life from your art practice. You're just going to run dry, you know, in terms of inspiration. So I took that on board. So I think, like, everything that you're interested in should come through somehow, and you should allow it to be there because then it's practically endless.
So when you did your gap year, where you started more or less doing art full time, is that when you changed your mind and decided to become an artist, following your father's footsteps?
Yeah, I think so. I went to the University College of Oslo, studying arts and craft with a little bit of teaching. So I could possibly become a teacher if I chose that path. But I think that kind of cemented this idea that I wanted to become an artist because the program there was kind of geared towards people who want to become teachers. And I realized my interests were so kind of rooted in the painting and the things that I wanted to look at there as a language in itself. And it felt kind of diluted. So that's when I went to look at what colleges kind of specifically focused on painting and drawing as a form. Not just fine art, but specifically. And that was when I applied for a bachelor at Edinburgh College of Art. Yeah, I felt it was important to kind of test it a bit further, because I think there can be a lot of regrets in life if you don't kind of follow something that you clearly have a talent for or a very particular interest in, maybe.
And you decided after you graduated to go to Chelsea to do an MA. What was that like?
So I was 27 when I graduated from Edinburgh, and I'd been curating a few shows and arranging a few exhibitions already. Because somebody told me quite early on that you need to take yourself serious as an artist, even when you're a student. So I took them on their word and started showing and started making a living already as a student. And then, so I had quite a few shows lined up after my BEA. And my partner, Marie, was in a very similar situation. So we sort of took the plunge and became full-time artists straight out of college, which was quite rare. I think we were the only ones in our year that managed to do this. And then after a few years of doing this, I thought, well, I should probably do an MA somewhere. Because with no other kind of plan, then, you know, I thought you have to have an MA. Obviously, you don't have to have an MA. But so I applied to Chelsea because it was a one-year MA, which was quite different from the other places, and probably quite a foolish idea to kind of, for me at least, who works quite slowly. I think for other people it could be perfect, but I already had solo shows lined up and I needed to kind of take a minimal amount of time to finish an MA. So that was the idea of it. And obviously then you have to live it, which was very different.
Was an MA at Chelsea largely theoretical rather than practical?
No, I think it was meant to be both, but I think you can't really focus a lot on a slow kind of studio practice in 1 year. So I think for a lot of people, it turned into more of a theoretical one. Maybe I kind of jokingly say that I got a little black belt in art self-defense, you know, in that year, you know, because it tests you and it asks questions and it doesn't seem very useful at first until maybe a few years after you've graduated and you look back and you're still using parts of that toolbox. So in that sense, I think it was a useful thing to do. And also it gives you a chance to take stock and saying like, yes, my professional life looks like this right now, but it could also look different if I put a different emphasis on it. So
who were your influences at that time, Christian? Because in your first major series, the Velvet Bloom series, you had a kind of mixture between realism, surrealism. There was great sort of contrast, confusions between interior and exteriors. Who were the influences behind that?
I think like back when I was making those things, I had been looking a lot at Richard Hamilton. And I think I still believe that I was heavily influenced by him then. But like looking at those pieces now, I think it was more a matter of kind of, because I was discussing what I used to call like visual filtering then. So individual visual filtering. So the way that we look at things differently and the filter we make for ourselves in terms of understanding the world. And I was trying to sort of manifest that in a very simple way. So there was a lot of kind of flat, very sparing backgrounds, stylized patterns, and then like a hyper-focus on something, usually faces or maybe some jeans or something, or, you know, different things that I was interested in painting very slowly and very meticulously. So I think they were more a manifestation of a certain focus and maybe like an oversimplification of that, maybe. But it needed to be done. And I think maybe Richard Hamilton sort of helped a bit in that, but a lot of other artists that I look at as well, you know, I could say the same thing. Because I think you take it all on board. And I mean, I remember like reading a lot of texts at the time and feeling like I had so much in common with these artists that I was reading. It's like, I think modern painters have like a collection of studio interviews with loads of artists. And I remember reading David Sow and thinking like, oh, we're exactly the same. And then I saw his actual works and I'm thinking we're nothing at all like each other.
Even that early stage, you had various motifs which have recurred throughout your practice. Let me give you a few, for example. Vertical lines and divisions, they've occurred in many of your works. Why is that?
It's something that I've also obviously noticed myself after a while, that I was kept doing this. And I think also in terms of talking about my work, I quite often mention the theatre. So if you think about the vertical line as the end of the stage, the curtain, so to speak, there's also like a top, there's the bottom. And in many ways, I think every painting is a piece of theatre. It's an empty stage with props on it, in a sense. And the artists are placing the props various places. And the viewer is kind of forced to look at it from that particular perspective. So in that sense, they're quite it shares a lot of similarities with a theatre. But also, I think I remember kind of looking back, you make narratives about how things came about. And you can't be sure if they're true or not. But I think there was one particular piece of printmaking that I saw at MoMA. I can't remember now, sadly, the artist's name. But I remember it was very formal. There was this door that was half ajar, so half open, into this, what I thought of it like almost like a ballroom. Some kind of party was going on there, but you could only glimpse a little bit. And there was this figure sitting right next to it in this particular print. And I was thinking, that's quite interesting because it kind of divides the surface into inside and outside this room. And then not only are you watching somebody watching something else, but you can't see exactly what. So there are almost like physical barriers. And I think that quite intrigued me. But in a way, it makes it very apparent to you that you are looking at a painting. The painting is sort of telling you that you are looking at a painting. This is not real life. And it makes you very aware that you're looking at it. So it's interfering with this sense that you are looking at real life in some ways. So, you know, I guess in a sense, this very strict vertical lines could just be little signs telling you that this is a painting.
Clock faces occur quite often too. And that to me talks about, well, time, obviously. Is it sort of the passage of time, or is it time as a concept?
I think it's both. I think it's also this idea of the circle divided into kind of equal parts, in a sense. And also, a few of the clock faces have this illusion that you can see through them. So it's the idea of the circular window, and this idea of, I guess, which is quite similar to the way our eyes is shaped as well, the way we look at the world. The circle is more akin to it than the square. So I don't know. The clocks themselves, I blame Pinterest for. Because I remember when the app came out, and I was quite excited about this idea of collecting in a very similar way to, I would go to, because I work from archives, I dig through all these archives in a very physical way. And then suddenly you have this online thing where people were showing their own selections from different archives, and you could sort of select their best kind of what you thought was interesting in their selections and then make your own sort of archive from that. And I thought it was just, because it was all about the archives, but then you could do this brilliant thing where you could look at your last 100 pins or something, and you could see them out without the categories. And I thought that's really interesting because we categorize everything we look at and we store them away. And then it's hard to know exactly what the categories are. We've gotten so used to them. And I thought, here's a possibility of kind of opening this up. So I made this rule for myself. I was going to collect everything that was interesting to me, no matter what it was of, if I liked the colors, if I liked the shape, everything. And when I opened it up, so it was just this one page full of images, I suddenly saw there was a lot of clocks on there. And I had no idea I was interested in clocks. And there was also certain colors that kind of really arrestingly told me that I have ignored these colors for a very long time in my painting. They need to be a part of it because obviously you like them. So it's simple as that, maybe.
Yeah. Another motif is this pattern that crops up time and time again. It's a sort of almost an op art type pattern, a maze-like pattern. Where did that come from, your subconscious, maybe?
No, it was that's more of one of my more sort of thought through, I guess, concepts, because I was thinking a lot about languages at the time. The reason I was thinking about it very specifically in terms of patterns and code, I guess, and maths, was because I was having this conversation with a couple of ladies in their 60s, and they were told me that they'd been computer experts in their youth. You know, they've been working with the punch card systems, organizing information and archiving information. And they were the experts until suddenly the world discovered that in computing there's a lot of money. So then suddenly that was a male occupation and they had no space anymore. So it was, but the contrast between that expertise that they had in their youth and the sort of disinterest in contemporary languages. So they could barely use an iPad, but they'd been experts in their youth, in their kind of, in that time's iPad, so to speak. And I thought, like, it's quite peculiar in terms of the time that we're living, that these digital languages are kind of like arising, being born. They're intricate languages, but they only have a short use before another one is taken over. So I thought I'd have a look at that. So I started looking through IBM's archives from these computing systems. Went to New York. They got headquarters in upstate New York, and had a look at what I could find, but on a pure visual level. And then obviously there was loads of imagery where I had no idea whether this was people with actual expertise depicted in the photos, whether it was models just kind of showcasing the apparatus or what it was. And this kind of lack of knowledge intrigued me as well. So I thought, I'm not going to learn about this. I'm not going to read anything about it. I'm just going to collect the visual, make a series of work from that, and then let the viewer be the expert. If they know anything about it, they can come and they can actually know what's going on here.
I'm one of those many that, you know, will use a computer, but I have no idea about how it actually works.
Yeah, it could be magic, for all we know.
Quite.
I'm the same. I have no idea how my iPhone works. You know, it could be magic or you know, divine intervention, for all I know. I would have no idea.
But you said about that punch culture is that it's a way of mirroring the way we construct and revise our notion of reality and sense of self without really knowing why. Can you elaborate a little on that?
Yeah, I think it's very connected to the narrative. So like when we are reconstructing our past in conversation, and maybe like daydreaming as well, but I think specifically in conversation, when you bring up an old memory, you will have to make a narrative out of singular events. And I think especially now when we have more data from our lives, you know, there's more to kind of collate these stories from. And I think there is a small reinvention whenever you bring out a memory, because it's shaded by the context that you're in. Just think about if you have siblings and you talk about your childhood, sometimes you talk about the same event and you have very different opinions about what actually happened. Maybe you felt like you weren't even there sometimes, you know. Certainly happens in my family.
But it certainly happens in mine. And I had a conversation that lasted about 50 years, seemingly, with my brother about who found this toy car on our way home from school. We never resolved it.
Exactly. No, but I think that's what we're talking about. Because then, with that model in mind about the toy car, if you then look at history and the way that we record history and look at trends and historical movements and philosophies about these trends and history, there's a certain kind of distrust, it's a strong word, but skepticism when it comes to reading imagery and reading texts as well. And I think that's become more transparent now when we realize that we weren't necessarily being lied to, but the information that we received and took for granted that this was going to be true was biased, and heavily biased too. So you start questioning things. And this is a healthy questioning, I think, where it opens up to the fact that language can be misinterpreted. And
yes,
it will never be precise enough to be absolute true.
And of course, today we live in our so-called post-truth society, where we can't really trust 100% anymore photography, even audio. And, you know, it's been feeding ground for populist politicians as well. I mean, I know that you touched on this in your Machinations series. How exactly did you approach that notion?
I think for me, an important thing in art and making art is that you sort of have to make it specific and personal. But that's quite hard when you're working with found photography. So looking through archives and then kind of selecting what you think looks great and then putting them together slowly with pencil on paper. I mean, it's a personal process in terms of you know, the way I selected and all those things. And that's the only thing I can kind of show. And I think then it's important to go back to maybe the very kind of primal notion of exploration, go back to childhood and look at why we share things and why we look at things and why we collect things. Because I have memories of picking up little pebbles on beaches or in the mountains and bringing them home for no other reason that they kind of look interesting to me. And more importantly, I sort of want to be able to share them later on. So it wasn't really about ownership. It wasn't really about knowledge about it or trying to make yourself an authority on this particular subject. It was more about the joy of finding and sharing. And I think that's sort of what we're left with when things are quite transparent and you can Google fact check most people's statements now, you know, which is very different from when I grew up, when you can say things with great confidence and people would just believe you because you sounded like you knew what you're talking about. And yeah. So I think machinations were my attempt at looking at something intricate, but not unpacking it in terms of text, but unpacking it in terms of imagery, and then showing those very specific pieces of information.
Let's take one of those pictures, Christian. Rasputin's hand. There you have a model, which is a bit like those you had in your Velvet Bloom series, in colour, and she's wearing these strange dark glasses. And behind her, two old military men, presumably Russian by the sound of the title, and a sky in the background. It's a bizarre picture, very attractive picture. You can't help but look at it, you know, with that inquisitive notion. I mean, part of it is black and white and part of it's colour. It's an enigmatic picture. How did you come by it?
At the time, I'd been reading a biography about Peter the Great. And then that had led me on to kind of study, or I wanted to read more, learn more about Russia at that time and before the revolution. And I'd been reading about Rasputin a little bit. And more importantly, I discovered that I had this picture of Rasputin sitting between the two guards that you can see in the painting. So he's sitting right in front of them, looking incredibly enigmatic and sort of frightening and like a wild prophet or some kind of dark priest. And then obviously you read about him and you read about how people were taken in by him. He had this incredible charisma and coming from a very poor background. And a very poor part of Russia, and then hanging out with the Tsar of all of Russia. Yeah, I mean, I later found out more information about him because I don't want to know too much when I paint. I think that kind of influences in the wrong way. I want to be able to play. So the only thing that's left of Rasputin in that painting is his hand, hence the title. So I don't know if you found it. It's like very stylized and just hanging properly right next to the shoulder of the lady, but. As you've noticed, a lot of my work recently and at that time as well is mainly monochrome. Sometimes there's a little bit of color in there, but it's a very pale color. And I think that's connected to my experience of documentary. Because when I was a kid, when you were talking about serious things like wars or politics, most of the footage was black and white. So it lent everything the seriousness and the sense of history. And it kind of... It levels the playing field a little bit. So you when you're looking at a black and white photo, you can easily fuse it with another one. And it's the same color, so to speak, without being flippant. So I think it's a good tool in terms of lending something a little bit of a timelessness and a little bit of take away some of the specific timing of it. Because you can kind of spot things by the age of the camera or the film or whatever paper. So the idea of that was kind of part of it. But I think also it was important for me because this was the poster painting for a show that I had in Oslo at Gallery Semmingsen in 2017. And it was quite large painting. And I wanted it to sort of, I mean, I didn't plan for it to be the poster painting, you know, I just paint things and then you decide later. But I wanted it to talk about sort of history in a very specific way. So when I was painting, you know, I was quite true to it. But the wonderful thing about painting is that you can move things around and back and forth. And so I changed perspective on the two guards a little bit in the background, you know, and exaggerated a few things on their faces because I liked it. I got to know them slowly through paint, and then they become your own kind of friends or family or acquaintances. And so it's based on something very true, but then it moves from that and becoming this fictional realm where that's very similar to theatre. So you can direct them and you can direct what's going on behind. And the model, I don't know if you noticed it, but in the glasses, there's sort of this black and yellow shape there, which was based on one of the other paintings in that series. So I've literally painted a mirroring of the painting that was hanging somewhere else in the show, of this DJ playing next to a crowd of Beatles fans in, I think, Osaka or something. And I like this idea of sort of plainly telling whoever's looking at it that this is fiction, but at the same time talking very seriously about what's in there and not letting fiction, the idea that it's fiction, take any of the seriousness away from it.
Hmm. We said earlier that you had used beautiful models for your Velvet Bloom series, but in your Incrimination / Intervention series, the women there, they are mainly women, are anything but models, because you've taken mugshots of prisoners as your starting point. Again, what was the idea behind that?
It was a bit of an accident, really. I mean, a lot of my work, yeah, depicts mainly, it's probably like 90% women in the paintings. But I think that kind of mirrors my life as well, to be honest. The art world is full of women, and my life is full of brilliant women. So I come from a family with sisters and grew up with a lot of women as well. So I think that's sort of... And also, I like looking at women, and I basically just paint whatever I want to paint, what I find interesting to look at, and I find also that it can be painting a woman that's not like very beautiful, a more normal looking woman, can be very subtle, because I think as a society for a long time, they've sort of fallen under the radar a little bit. And obviously, as a society, we're trying to correct that now. And I think maybe subconsciously, I was trying to use that fact that they were more subtle to talk about more subtle things. So towards the end of Machinations, I was desperately looking for women in the sciences that had received awards, etc., because I wanted to make a series about them. And I found a couple, but... most of them were not photographed, and I couldn't find them anywhere. And when they were photographed, I noticed they were usually standing next to an older male that was sort of validating them by handing them a medal or something, and being almost more in the focus line than the woman was. And I thought, in a painting you can change this, you know, you can change it. And I think that's how I got to the mugshots, because I accidentally started drawing this incredibly, for me, intriguing black woman that I later learned was Mary Most, who was in prison for murdering her husband. And she was heavily pregnant when she was arrested. And when I was drawing her, it was partly this idea that I had in my mind at the moment, through conversations with people at the time. I don't know how it came about, but I was just thinking, I had this very strong sense that I could have been anyone on this planet. You know, it's just so random where you're born and who you become. And I was thinking, I could have been absolutely anyone. And I looked at her face and I was thinking, what if I was this person? You know, what would have led me here? What would have gone on? And I think, like, when you're drawing something at the pace I'm doing, usually it could take a couple of weeks or 3 weeks or whatever to finish a drawing, then you have time to really explore every single part of the face and you get to know them in a very different way. And it's sort of a way of ruminating or letting sort of these thoughts percolate a little bit and taking it into yourself, learning about it in a very different way. So I was drawing Mary and not knowing her name or knowing anything about it at the time. It was just about the face. And then I had this suspicion that she might be pregnant. So I changed her clothes a little bit to sort of cover her and protect her a bit, because I felt she felt so vulnerable. And at the same time, she had this immense strength. What I read from her face, it was this immense strength, but also hopelessness. So I sort of turned her braids around a little bit, covered part of her face, and sort of tried to do what I can to kind of rewrite this moment for her. As if she was me, you know, when you're insecure or something, you tend to cover your face a little bit. And I thought, like, well, that's something I can actually do. But her face has featured later in various configurations. Most of what I did after then, I'd never worked as purely with one face again on the mugshots, because I wanted to protect them a little bit more. So I would borrow eyes and jawlines and noses and just sort of interchange them, because I was digging through the archives and trying to find things. And I would combine them to sort of make new people that would represent them rather than sort of exposing the particular people. So Mary, she's been a Russian admiral. She's been a priest. She's had a very rich life in my paintings since then. And I think that's kind of my way of in a way saying, I guess, I wish your life was different.
One painting of yours that did get a lot of exposure was the one Interventions 4, which won the Vicarage Art Prize from the Federation of British Artists. Now, in that one, you have three women, two older in sort of black peasant costumes, a younger one in a patterned dress. And you've got this time the geometric vertical lines are of wood and aluminium. And you've blocked it. So it's almost like a sculpture, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, that was something that literally was raised as a question, I guess, when I'd discovered that I did these vertical lines everywhere. And then I was thinking, what if I actually make them physical barriers? What if I make them of different materials? And I don't initially like the idea of framing my work behind sort of, for the work to be behind glass and with a traditional frame, because I think a painting or a drawing as an object, I mean, everything matters. So a frame can change something massively, and then you have to really think about what material is it, what does it look like? And for a lot of drawings, it's not really thought about that much. It's a bit like a helmet for us, you know, it's just there to protect, and you don't really care what it looks like, but it really governs how you look at the piece in the first place. And I think for me, I just wanted to explore that a bit, examine it, and thinking like, what would be a good surface for me? What would be a good object? So a drawing as an object on the wall, what would it look like? And I was quite enamored with this idea of the tablet. So looking at, you know, anything from like the tablets of Moses or whatever, you know, this idea of this kind of like precious tablets that you would be able to hold in your hands. But at the same time, they would convey, they were more than just the writing. So I started small at a residency in New York and worked with some wood, worked with some perspex and different materials. And then that particular piece that won the prize was a half collaboration with Artist Surfaces in Kent. So they made the aluminium and wood panels. And then I went down to visit them. I worked on for a whole week on sort of finding, because I knew how to glue together the perspex and use those kind of techniques and polish it. So that was a nice collaboration. And then once I had the objects, I didn't know what to draw on them or anything. So that one is a painting. Some of them were drawings. And it was just finding out how can I explore this interplay between physical form and the illusion of physical form, and try to look convincing together somehow.
I must ask you about another series, Rose Windows. They're very striking. They're painted in a sort of monochrome, a shade of green monochrome. Take one reflection of a young woman while the window is illuminating four rather ghostly figures in the background. It's a bit like you were saying about the work that your father did. It's a bit like a tableau, isn't it? Some sort of scenario, like a very theatrical.
Yeah. I mean, I think I used the word operatic for that series somehow, because I felt like it was like almost grander than the theatre in some sense. Not artificially sort of grand, but a little bit, like the opera. You know, you might want to dress up a little bit to go in there and to watch it like an opera, as opposed to like a matinee or something that you're just popping in to see. And I think, like, because the first rose window painting was made during the pandemic, and I think as the world kind of shrunk around you, certainly I felt like I needed to expand it in my own way, maybe even if it was just inside the studio, and make it like, and the second thing is, nobody was watching me at the time. There was no deadlines, there was no kind of pressure on making specific things for specific project. And I just finished the last of the mugshot drawings, which was the research was supported by the Norwegian government. I got a stipend to kind of look into this, and it was a serious matter, and it was very specific. And I thought, like, now I can play a bit, I can expand a bit, and instead of like having minimal information in the works, I can maximize it. I can throw everything in there and just literally make a little tableau, as you say, and put whatever I'd like in there. And some of the faces in there were mugshots, so, you know, they could be part of it, but nobody knows it. So that kind of changed the outlook, and I could know that, and I wouldn't necessarily tell anyone when they're looking at it. So I think, and also I had been exploring that particular pigment, which is a mixture between a sap green, and it's this wonderfully translucent and kind of almost glowing paint, and phthalo blue. So when you mix them with just a little bit of blue in the green, it becomes this wonderful, wonderful color that has a little bit, it's a blue, so it is distant from you, which makes you kind of feel like there's a distance between you and what you're looking at. But the hint of a little bit of warmth sort of gives it a little bit of charm and a little bit of a glow. And I thought, like, what if I only use this one pigment and try to build up the entire surface slowly over time? I mean, that particular painting was painted only in acrylics, and very thin acrylics. It was, what you see as black there is just the solid pigment, and the thinner parts are just it diluted. So it's this interesting exploration into the actual pigment as well as the subject matter. So, and it was quite, they were also quite large. So it was almost body size for me, and I'm about 2 meters tall. So they were 2 meters painting. So quite large. I felt like it was life size for me.
Yeah, you are the tallest artist I've ever interviewed. Another recent series called The Other, you've described as, you know, the impossibility of imagining with any accuracy from imagination or dreaming. But so you're attempting the impossible with this series, are you?
Yeah, I guess. Like, I guess, like, all paintings are attempting the impossible, sort of making what we see as 3D believable in a flat form. So in that sense, I guess we are. But I think when there's a lot going on in the world, then you're thinking about what is safe, what's unsafe, what is known to you, what is unknown to you. And they can become quite polarized. But I think there's the matter of the other, that which is just slightly beyond us, and that can be sublime. You know, it doesn't have to be scary, but it's just right outside your knowledge base, and it's slightly unfamiliar. And it's quite fertile ground for dreams and daydreams and sort of like, even like longings for something. And I just wanted to explore this idea somehow. So I think of, like, as you've noticed, I work in series and I give them sort of names, but they're really just, I think of every single painting or drawing as an argument, you know, sort of thesis of some sort, or an essay. So series will be the essay, and then you're going to have the arguments, however many you need. Some are supporting, some are disagreeing, And I think the only valid way of replying to a painting is with another one. So in a sense, I guess there were just an exploration where you're saying, okay, this is the premise. The other premise with that series was that I was going to take something from that first drawing, and that was going to migrate into the next drawing. And then I was going to expand on it or subtract from it. And then something from that drawing would go into the next, and so on, until you had this series. And at the very end of the series, I sort of circled back and took some from the first drawing, which was the other, and sort of linked them up and kind of into a nice package, almost as if I'd planned it in a kind of ironical way. Because obviously, if you explore, you can't pre-plan. You have to go looking, and you have to really kind of stay sensitive throughout the process. So very different from illustration in that sense. So things happen to you, and then you react to that, and then you use this surprise or whatever it is that you, when you find things, to generate something else, and so you kind of skip from stone to stone, so to speak.
Christian, thank you very much for talking about your work. It's been lovely listening to you. You could have been a portrait artist, you could have been an architectural artist, a surrealist, a hyper-realist. It's all there. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you so much, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Christian Evju, kicking off Considering Art for 2024. Thanks for listening. This is Bob Jaundy, hoping you'll join me for more interesting interviews this coming year.